Welcome to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I'm holding in front of me a copy of today's New York Times, which has this extraordinary glimpse into the mind of the President of the United States, sort of a look inside the President's lurid imagination. This is what the Times reports. Privately, the President had often talked about fortifying a border wall with a water-filled trench stocked with snakes or alligators, prompting aides to seek a cost estimate. He wanted the wall electrified, with spikes on top that would pierce human flesh. After publicly suggesting that soldiers shoot migrants if they threw rocks, the president backed off when his staff told him that was illegal. But later in a meeting, aides recalled, he suggested they shoot migrants in the legs to slow them down. That's not allowed either, they told him. And of course, this is the backdrop of the president tweeting out, accusing his critics of treason, suggesting that the impeachment process is a coup. So this seemed like a perfect day to talk about the politics of prudence, right? So we are joined by Greg Wiener, who is a political scientist at Assumption College, where he is also the provost and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and the author of a recent book, Old Whigs, Burke, Lincoln, and the Politics of Prudence. Greg Wiener, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about the politics of prudence, which seems to be a radically countercultural idea these days, since all of the incentive structure of our political and media system seem to be designed to reward imprudence. So I have been fascinated by your thesis, the book about old Whigs. Can we just start talking about how do you define political prudence?
Sure. I think it's best understood as the calibration of statecraft to circumstance. So that prudence, when we use it today, we generally mean caution when we use it colloquially. And I do think prudence entails an important dimension of caution. Edmund Burke theorized that most fully, but it's not limited to that. There are times when you can think of Munich or other occasions when the prudent action is the bold action. The problem I think we have culturally, as you alluded to, is that we have a tendency to see everything as urgent, in which case, as I think I say in the book, if every issue is ultimate, then none are. So we seem to have no incentives for prudence and no sense of the perspective that prudence entails.
Yeah, I mean, if everything is a crisis, if everything is Flight 93, then nothing really is. So you lump together Edmund Burke and Abraham Lincoln, which is interesting. It's not an obvious connection. So tell me what is the connection between Burke and Lincoln?
Well, the superficial connection, it's a little bit more than superficial, is that they both referred to themselves as old Whigs, which I do think has something to say about their politics. But the more interesting connection to me is they both wrote, Burke more so than Lincoln, but wrote in ways that suggested a prudent disposition. And both had very prudent dispositions, but had to be daring in their statecraft. So I think it helps us to illuminate dimensions of prudence that we have a tendency to overlook.
So talk a little bit about what it means to be an old Whig.
Well, the Whig Party in both Britain and America was defined by its legislative supremacy, or at least its assertion of legislative power. In Britain, that was the sort of country faction against the court faction. In America, that the Whigs split off from the Democrats in opposition to the what we might call the Democratic royalism of Andrew Jackson. So that I think is a perspective that is sorely lacking in American politics today. When people who running for president tend to say, "I will do this, I will do that," and they expect members of Congress to just line up behind them rather than having their own institutional interest.
Edmund Burke, I think you can make a strong case that Edmund Burke is the founder of modern conservatism, although there's not a lot left in the modern conservative movement of Burkeanism. But talk a little bit about the prudent statesmanship. When he came into Parliament back in the mid-18th century, 1765, he was quite critical of the British policy towards the United States, toward the colonies at that time. But I think he's probably best remembered for his writings about the revolution in France, which seemed to crystallize his view and his critique of radicalism. So talk a little bit about what we mean when we talk about Burkeanism.
Well, I think what we mean when we talk about Burkeanism, or at least what I mean, is an emphasis on prudence, and particularly on moral prudence. Prudence is virtue with moral dimension. So Burke, in the Reflections on the Revolution in France, refers to his ancestors in Britain as having had a moral rather than a complexional timidity, meaning that they were timid because they had an appropriate skepticism of human reason and a proper understanding of the limits of human reason, especially when we're talking about something as complicated as human beings and as infinitely complicated as human beings living in society. So I think that dimension of prudence, which you don't really get in the early masters of prudence, are we think of Aristotle and Aquinas and so forth. But Burke, I think, really gives it a wonderful dimension that it doesn't have before, that's grounded in that skepticism of human reason.
And he was also a practical politician who would argue that simply because you can do something or you have the right to do something, it's not a good idea to do it. That it's not right. Always that even though you might have justification for an action, and even though you might be successful in the action, it would be unwise to take those actions.
Right, which was substantially what he said about the conflict with America. He said at one point that I wish you were not so, you meaning the British Parliament, were not so encumbered by your dignity, because it's forever at war with your policy. Meaning that your notion of your own imperial rights is getting in the way of what's actually good for the British Empire.
So then you link him together with Lincoln. Now, a lot of folks would think of Lincoln as a radical transformative figure who abolished slavery, who was a wartime president, who was certainly bold in his actions and in many ways ruthless in waging war. So How does Lincoln fit into this thesis about the politics of prudence?
Well, I think Lincoln is a very fine example of two points. One is that sometimes prudence does in fact require boldness. In a civil war, a time of rebellion would certainly be one of those. But Lincoln, well before the Civil War, I think had theorized prudence quite nicely. In his 1838 Lyceum address, he says, which is a time of relative peace and prosperity, he says the greatest threat to freedom in America is going to be the pursuit of greatness or legacy and ambition in times that don't require it. And that, I think, is a dimension of prudence that we have completely lost. Every president wants to be transformative, regardless of whether the circumstances demand it.
It's also interesting that both Edmund Burke and Abraham Lincoln were incredibly literate men, remembered for their eloquence and their style, which also is quite a contrast to our current age.
That's true, and they
putting it mildly.
Yes. They certainly didn't write in 280 characters at a time, although they did. Lincoln, in particular, had a gift for concision. I think what we're missing there in today's politics is any room at all for nuance. So if you think, for example, to Lincoln's second inaugural, to say that this war may be punishment of both sides for the sins involved in the nationwide tolerance of slavery is something one would never hear today. We're much more accustomed to an us and them or with me or against me type of politics.
This brings to mind the debate that we're having internally on the right between the Sora Bamares and the David Frenchists, and I'm a self-proclaimed Frenchist, where the Amari folks are basically arguing that yes, we ought to treat everything as a world historical crisis, as a cultural crisis, and that we ought to demand victory as opposed to accommodation. Is that kind of a parallel, the debate that we're having right now about, isn't that really also a debate about prudence and about tolerance and restraint?
I think it is. I mean, I think the Amari side has a point when it talks about the importance of the nation and a national identity, which were important to both Burke and to Lincoln. But the idea that everything is this sort of Carl Schmittian moment of ultimate conflict, I think is fundamentally at war with prudence.
Well, let's talk about where we're at right now. The president of the United States, who would never be accused of prudence in any way, you've written about this, the president's invocation of the word treason and the fact that he brings it up again and again and again. It's not just a one-off. It's not a random word, is it? It really does capture something about his view of his office and of our system, doesn't it?
I think ultimately what it captures is his view of himself, which he equates with the office. So there's no difference in his mind. I mean, treason would be betraying the country. This whistleblower he's accusing of betraying him personally. So to conflate the two, I think, is a real problem. To say nothing of the fact that the Constitution, you know, when you apply this term to Adam Schiff, the Constitution contains a speech and debate clause that says you can't arrest members, other than for literal treason, which obviously doesn't apply here, that you can't arrest members of Congress for the performance of their official duties.
You wrote a very interesting piece for the New York Times in the last week that Trump has overplayed his hands, and you begin it this way. Empires collapse when they overreach. The imperial presidency is no different. It has long been disdainful of Congress, but now under the Trump administration, it is reaching a peak of contempt for it. Even so, President Trump's recent aggrandizement of the executive branch may have the ironic and salutary effect of shrinking the power of the presidency by awakening the countervailing power of a long dormant Congress. Now, I think that puts us in a very, very interesting context because, you know, just setting aside his own misconduct and his abuse of power, one of the things that I think has been so dramatically on display in the last couple of years has been this constitutional imbalance. How much power we've invested in the presidency and how that's been accompanied by a shrinking Congress. So in many ways, this impeachment proceeding is a check on this imperial presidency, isn't it?
I think it is. And the imperial presidency goes way back, either to, depending on your perspective, to the New Deal or the Cold War or whenever else. And there's unquestionably in my mind, President Obama bears responsibility for taking the imperial presidency into domestic issues in a way that it hadn't before. But when I say we're reaching a peak of contempt for Congress, it matters to me that we're not even going through the motions of respect for Congress anymore. So the point of the essay that you referenced was this may be a point of overreach to thumb his nose at Congress in so many explicit ways all at the same time. Seems to have awakened Congress simply by prodding them so much. And to me, what was actually a much more interesting moment than the eruption of the sort of barreling toward impeachment was when Adam Schiff said he might deprive the acting director of national intelligence of funds for his personal office unless he supplied the whistleblower complaint. That to me signifies a revival of institutional combat, which is what Madison relies on to maintain the separation of power. So I think that may have actually been a much more telling moment.
This has been one of the puzzles. It was certainly one of the puzzles of the first 2 years. And going back to, you know, Madison's vision of the balancing of powers, he was counting on jealousies of power, ambition countering ambition, to check the power of the president. And yet, we have seen the willingness of United States senators and people who are regarded as institutionalists willing to essentially turn themselves into potted plants, not, you know, pushing back. Even under Franklin Roosevelt, Democrats, members of his own party in the United States Senate, were very, very jealous of their prerogatives, were not willing to simply go along, didn't think of themselves as simply members of the president's team. And that has been a remarkable development. What you're describing is an awakening of the dangers of doing that. But we went down that road pretty far, didn't we?
We did. Roosevelt, in fact, had dozens of vetoes in his first 2 years in office when he was at the peak of his popularity and controlled both. I mean, his entire presidency, he controlled both branches of Congress, but there was a sense of institutional independence there. The great question for me, what's really interesting about this is why this has happened, because in Madisonian terms, it's just inconceivable. When Madison says ambition must be made to counteract ambition in Federalist 51, he seems simply to assume that you run for office because you want power. Now, it's inconceivable to Madison in 1787, 1788, 89, and so forth, that you would run for power because there's some sort of glamour associated with serving in Congress, right? Because there simply wasn't back then, or at least not in the same way that there is today. So I think Madison doesn't predict, and we can't fault him for it, the sort of celebrity culture that surrounded Congress. But I think that's the ultimate question here is how do we reorder the motives for serving in Congress?
Yeah, you mentioned in the essay the key to understanding how ambition maintains the separation of powers comes actually before the line about ambition, counteracting ambition in Federalist 51. But the great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachments of the others. And as you point out, Congress has long had the means to resist the presidency. It now appears to be reviving a desire to use them. Well, let me just be a little bit skeptical here, though. We're seeing this with Democrats are willing to do this against Republicans. Republicans are willing to rattle the cage when there is a Democrat in office. Will Democrats in Congress have the same jealousy of their prerogatives if we had a President Elizabeth Warren or a President Bernie Sanders or a President Joe Biden?
Well, they didn't under President Obama.
They certainly did not. No,
I think that skepticism is legitimate. But if what we're seeing now is a reorientation of the conversation toward institutional prerogative and not simply toward I don't like this president or I do, then I think that there's some reason to hope that we're at least beginning to see the inklings of a change.
How do we get back to a political culture that respects prudence? Because as you know, anyone on either side of the political divide that urges prudence, they're going to be accused of being weak. They're going to be accused of wanting to lose more slowly. This has been the kind of the essence of Trumpism is that we tried prudence and look where it got us. And on the Democratic side as well, you know, people who talk about, hey, you know, let's actually work for compromise, you know, they're being shoved aside by the folks that are more interested in scratching their ideological id. So I guess the question is the culture, the social media infrastructure that we have right now, does it make it possible to get back?
The social media infrastructure doesn't help in two ways. One is that it speeds things up in a way that the constitutional design doesn't foresee. The Constitution depends on the power of time to diffuse passions. And we now have sort of passions in real time in a way that the founders don't anticipate. The second, and I think probably more disturbing, is the way that the fragmentation of media allows us to live in our own private realities. So that if you took the same story and looked solely at MSNBC or solely at Fox News, you'd be living in a completely different universe. Having said that, I'm not quite willing to give up on prudence yet. And the reason is this. You mentioned that we associate it with weakness. And what may be worse than that, by the way, is that not simply that you get criticized, but that you get laughed at. If you recall the Dana Carvey line, a tagline on of his impression of George H.W. Bush was "wouldn't be prudent." In the end, though, our politics tends to be a pretty good reflection of us. As much as we like to say we've been betrayed, or so and so is serving special interests and is corrupt, and so on and so forth. The fact is, the nice thing about American politics and Democratic politics in general is that the person with the most votes always wins. And if we decide that, you know, the contributions notwithstanding or social media notwithstanding, that we care about prudence, then I think we're going to see a revival of it. But that is a great project of civic education that will not turn on a dime.
the person with the most votes always wins, except if they're running for president.
That's true. So, right. Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I'm a defender of the Electoral College, but that's
tell me about that. You are a defender of the Electoral College. I am too, but I have to admit that I'm my skepticism is growing about it. So and of course, if we have another election where let's imagine that one candidate wins the popular vote by 5 million votes and does not win the presidency, you're going to have a major debate about political reform in this country.
I think that's probably right. Although I remember on election night in 2000, someone saying, "If God forbid the candidate with fewer popular votes wins the electoral votes, we're going to have demonstrations in the streets and so on and so forth." And that didn't turn out to be the case. I think the case for skepticism would be if we end up with a structural phenomenon where one party is consistently benefiting from the imbalance between electoral and popular votes. The case for it, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who I wrote a prior book about, gave a wonderful speech on this topic in the Senate in, give or take 1978, when Birch Bayh was pushing the abolition of the Electoral College, in which he said the genius of the American system is you can't do anything unless it's been approved by two majorities. Right, so the Electoral College brings in the majority of the states as well as the majority of the people. Now, there can be a conflict there, but it seems to me the scenario we get when if we go to a strictly popular vote, I mean, there are practical problems, like what would you do if there was a close election and you had to do a nationwide recount that I think may be insuperable. But the bigger problem is I do think it's the typical defense of the Electoral College, I think, is compelling, which is that you would have huge swaths of the country that would simply be ignored in favor of the major population centers. So President Trump, by the way, is not wrong when he says that had it been a popular vote, I would have run a different kind of campaign. I don't think he would have prevailed, but certainly he wouldn't have ignored California and so on and so forth.
Well, you know, and by the way, I find that argument persuasive, you know, particularly because I live in flyover country and I understand that we, in fact, you know, would be ignored. But the flip side of that is that the way the Electoral College map is shaping up, the candidates can ignore big swaths of the country. And I remember thinking, and again, I'm a supporter of the Electoral College. I'm just having doubts. I'm sharing them with you. When the president went after Baltimore, rat-infested Baltimore, and how terrible it was and everything, it occurred to me that this was a free shot for the president of the United States to attack a city like Baltimore because it was in a state that was really not competitive. He can say or do anything to California because he does not need to worry about them. So that rather than having a president who is president of all Americans, who is answerable to all Americans, there are parts of the country that now he can insult, punish, ignore, and that does seem to be problematic as well. So yes, without the Electoral College, you might have vast swaths of the country that are ignored. But with the Electoral College, there are vast swaths of the country that are ignored. And we see the consequences of that with a president who feels free to, you know, again, drop bombs on them occasionally.
I think that's a fair point. The only thing I would caution against is extrapolating too much from this one president who is, I hope, a unique phenomenon in American politics, certainly is sui generis. So, the typical pivot that we expect presidents to make is they run hard and then they pivot to being president for the whole people. That's not to say that President Obama or Bush or whomever else was perfect in that regard, but when you conflate the office with yourself, I think it really aggravates that problem when every criticism of you or of your policy is a personal attack on you, and even worse than that, an attack on the country. I think the it tends to justify the kind of behavior you're describing.
So do you think that he's a one-off? I mean, this is, I think, is one of the more urgent questions of our politics, because clearly if everything if the dysfunction of our culture and our system was not a pre-existing condition, Donald Trump wouldn't be the president of the United States. So to what extent is he a symptom of something deeper and more enduring? And to what extent is he just, you know, sui generis?
Well, I think it's hard to tear those apart. I mean, clearly the culture allowed that to come through, and clearly there were latent facets of the culture that emerged in his support. I'm not prepared to say definitively that he's a one-off. What I'm not prepared to do, I think that's more important, is to say that American politics has been permanently altered in this direction. So, the great question will be whether the next president, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, is tweeting at 4 a.m. and using schoolyard nicknames for opponents and so on and so forth. I think, by the way, I get a lot of criticism for this, but I think those norms of the office, the dignity of the office, tend to be more important and enduring than policies, which by their nature are transient.
But the norms have proved to be incredibly fragile, haven't they?
Well, there's been a moment of fragility. The norms are fragile in the sense that the minute you figure out you can break them and you're willing to break them, they're not that hard to break. But that willingness is the key step. So if in fact we continue to value, as we seem to really value, this sort of boorish behavior, then I think the norms are not coming back. But I'm not quite ready to say that's where we are. I mean, the norms have quite a lot of inertia behind them, and in fact the whole constitutional system has a lot of inertia behind it that I think is hard to derail in a single presidency.
See, I'm hoping you are right. I am desperately hoping you are right, because I think there's two models that I try to balance in my mind. Is one is the pendulum theory, that when you go too far, that the American system, you know, will bring you back to some sort of a center point, that things will swing back and forth. The other is the ratchet, which is that every time you violate a norm, every time you accept unacceptable behavior, you know, you move down, and it becomes very, very difficult. And I guess that's the problem with norms, that they turned out that we assumed that certain things could not be done. We assumed that there were certain checks, and now we're finding out that they can be brushed aside, and that the folks that you would expect to step up to defend those norms just are not around.
Well, I think what we're finding out is that we as a people may be more tolerant of those violations than we ought to be. I mean, this all comes down to the question with which we began, which is prudence, which is to say, if in fact we're experiencing a crisis of the regime, right, which is by the way what Trump supporters have been saying. But if from the opposite direction, Trump represents a crisis of the regime, then bold action is, for the sake of correction, is necessary. But I think that cautious dimension of prudence ought to counsel us to say, not to catastrophize too much over one admittedly dramatic intervention in history.
So we started off by talking about your book, The Old Whigs, and the fact that Abraham Lincoln, throughout his entire life, described himself as an old Whig. But there are no more Whigs anymore. So what happened to the Whigs? And is it a cautionary tale that major political parties can, in fact, just vanish?
Well, they tend to vanish when they lose their reason for being, and when and new parties tend to emerge when there's a particularly intense new issue, which is what happened historically to the Whigs, as they were able to articulate what they were not, but not what they were. And when the intense... When slavery reached a peak of intensity, the ground was set for a new party. I do wonder if we're in conditions that would be conducive to a new sort of, for lack of a better way of putting it, constitutionalist party. I'm a little bit skeptical of that, because the American system puts so much stock in a two-party approach. But we may be at a point where certainly the Republican Party is undergoing a dramatic change in identity. The Democratic Party is going to have to, if it hopes to counter that in any effective way, is going to have to be able to articulate what it's for, and not simply that it's not Trump. And by the way, it's going to have to do so in a way that you don't have what Burke called an ideological auction, where the furthest left position necessarily wins.
The Whigs were destroyed because they by the divisions over slavery. I mean, it took something. Right. Am I correct about that? I mean,
correct. Yes.
It took something, one of these world historical crises, to break apart that party. You would think that the divisions in the country now might have a similar effect, except there is no division like that within the Republican Party. That there were Whigs who were willing to break on principle, on a fundamental principle, which is how we got the Republican Party, how we got Abraham Lincoln. But so far, you know, the number of Republicans willing to break on fundamental principle is vanishingly small.
It is vanishingly small. And George Will has pointed out that Trump has much higher support among Republicans than Reagan ever did.
It's remarkable.
It is remarkable. It's a bit hard to say whether the polarization that we're seeing is adequate to induce a new party, because it was, I don't want to quite say a single issue polarization when the Republican Party formed, but it was certainly closer to that, to one single identifiable division than we are now. We seem to be polarized along a lot of different lines today.
Greg Wiener, thank you so much for spending time with us today. The book is Burke, well, Old Whigs, Burke, Lincoln, and the Politics of Prudence. And you have had a number of stories in the New York Times, and we appreciate your contributions to the Bulwark as well. So thanks for spending time with us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.